You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network.
So I've got Terry George with me, great director, writer, but among other things, you directed and wrote Hotel Rwanda.
And the film The Promise, which is a love story set during the Armenian Genocide, probably won't be out till like November.
I kind of think it's funny though that essentially you're like the genocide guy. I don't mean to make fun of that. But like Hotel Rwanda was so moving and so important at the same time, and yet you've and it's about such an important historical topic, and you hit it from so many ways in terms of the issue. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's still a story, and that's how you communicate it.
Yeah.
So really, I want to get right to the heart of the matter, which is, A, where do you come from? Like, why is suffering and art so interwoven with you? Mm. And B, how do you do it? So those are the kind of the main things I want to cover. So who the hell are you?
I'll answer that. One word answer to the first question. I'm from Belfast in Ireland.
Oh, I couldn't tell from your accent.
How do you empathize with suffering? I'm from Ireland. I'm Irish.
And just to mention, by the way, you're Irish, and you even mentioned in one interview that I've read that, you know, obviously the Rwandan genocide was a genocide, but you do make some parallels between what happens in Ireland to Rwanda.
Very much so. I mean, I grew up in Belfast right at the, I was 16 when this phase of the Troubles broke out. 1969 was the, it sort of rolled from 1966 through 1969.
As you were about like 17 at that time?
Yeah, it was my formative years from 69 through till 78. I was deeply embroiled in the troubles there, the war. And it went from, classically, from a civil rights uprising to a street rebellion to guerrilla warfare till this very focused, not high tech, but very intense war between the IRA and the British through that period. And that for me was my education.
But like you say, 1969 was not only the peak of that, it was the peak of sort of youth revolutions all around, like in France, in the US, but in Ireland in particular, because you're dealing with this sort of national uprising as well, and civil rights and so on. So how did you personally get involved in what was going on?
Well, we were, I mean, that was the time of, you know, the uprising in Paris, the civil rights movement in the United States, and what was taking place in Northern Ireland, we saw as part of that worldwide movement of people struggling for civil rights. It was basically the Catholic population had felt and were oppressed by a, you know, a dictatorship or a dominant government that discriminated against the Catholic population. So there was a sense of indignation, but also a sense of allegiance with what was taking place in the United States, what was taking place in Europe, you know, and the people I grew up with just felt invigorated by that and became involved in a civil rights movement. But because of the history of Ireland, that civil rights movement was deeply intertwined with the question of Ireland being divided by the British, north and south, you know, that the British had occupied Ireland, had left the southern part and still occupied the north. So there was this thing of civil rights meets this nationalist struggle. And the IRA had been, you know, the dominant, they had actually driven the British out in the south and were still a potent force in the north. So you had a weird mix there of like civil rights movement and guerrilla movement going on.
Right. So, but you're almost like separating it in terms of like civil rights movement / you know, IRA and youth / guerrilla movement. But somehow or other, it all sort of merged together. Like you were participating. You weren't just sort of protesting in the streets. What was actually going on in your life at that moment?
Yeah, well, everybody was participating. If you were Catholic and you were from these working class neighborhoods, you were just embroiled in this. Literally, it went from the police force, which was totally dominated by the Unionist Protestant government, attacking those areas. And the police force being backed up by sort of loyalist militia and Protestant gangs. And then when the British Army came in 69, they quickly switched to supporting that establishment. So you ended up living in a neighborhood that was under siege from not just this police force, this sectarian police force, but then by the British Army. So you were basically under siege. It was a classic situation of a local population being dominated by an occupation army, as we saw it.
And so you're there young, angry, your friends are starting to get connected up to, you know, more active parts of this movement. What was your path through this movement? Because now there's a long time between 1969 and when you started getting more active in, let's say, other issues in the film industry and so on.
Yeah.
So, okay, what takes you from 1969 all the way through to Rwanda? Like, what's kind of the artistic path? I know you were a journalist covering these issues. Like, how did you kind of start to translate suffering to story?
Well, what took me there, my own personal experience in Northern Ireland were, you know, I grew up in my family were from a working class Catholic neighborhood. My father aspired to be middle class. He had a small auto shop. He fixed cars. He sold secondhand cars. And he moved up into a middle class, predominantly Protestant neighborhood.
Did they treat him okay?
No. Well, they did. After 69, when the troubles blew up, we were quickly like persecuted. The house was wrecked, the windows were broken, we were driven out of there. And at the same time, the neighborhood where he had come from which was this very hardcore Catholic IRA neighborhood that was basically under siege from a sort of all of East Belfast, which is where we were from, became a, when the Troubles broke out, became a really hardcore IRA area. And that, because of the division in the society then, was where I had to go to hang out as a kid. I couldn't hang out in the neighborhood where I, where we had our house.
Were you picked on, like, by other kids?
Yeah, we could be. You know, I was, like, our wall was painted, like, no Pope here, and I was a Fenian, and I got beaten up in fucking playgrounds and shit like that. Yeah, there was definitely a sense that you were not welcome, to put it mildly.
I just want to add that the way you just put it, you were beat up in fucking playgrounds. Like, yeah. Just why playgrounds?
Because I remember there was an incident where we went to, a couple of times where I went with a cousin and went to a playground and somebody fingered us as like, they're Fenians, which was the slang for Catholics. And we literally got beat up and chased out of there, you know. And what was it? There was all these, you know, these funny incidents you recall from your childhood. I joined this thing called St. John's Ambulance, which was like a volunteer ambulance corps. And when you were a kid, it meant you got to go to like football matches because you were doing first aid and shit like that. You know, you could stand at the sideline or you could go to a cinema as the first aid person. And I went to this cinema one time. The Windsor Cinema on the Woodstock Road, and somebody threw a fucking hole at the whole chair of the cinema, like the seat, down at me. And I thought, I didn't know what I thought. I thought like there was some mistake or something like that. And the woman says, "You better get out of here." And I said, "What?" She said, "Because you're a Fenian, you know." They're,
Can I ask a naive question? Yeah. Because I don't really know the answer, so it's totally naive. But Protestants and Catholics are all Christians, and I know there's a lot of strife between them, but when you get right down to the core of what Jesus said, what's the big deal?
It's economics. You have to understand the history of Europe and the history of the British Empire and the division of it. Like, okay, you know, Henry VIII was a Christian.
Right.
But he chopped his house waves.
500 years ago, though.
But that legacy, that culture of the division of European society into, you know, the Catholic society and the Protestant, Martin Luther and then Huguenots, that's caused as much violence as the Shia-Sunni division has done today, more so. And it crystallized in Northern Ireland because in Ireland, the British used that division as a way to control the country. And you know, I know it's 500 years of history, but being Jewish, you know, like, you know, you're dealing with 2,000 years or whatever. It's the legacy of that, and ultimately it ends up in economics. The Catholic nationalist population in Northern Ireland were the, you know, the underclass, and the Protestant working class population felt as though they were the privileged class. They were the shipbuilders. They were the ones that helped build the British Empire. They had been empowered by their allegiance to the crown.
So starting from that, then this movement is kind of breaking out. And I know you got into journalism. It was kind of your first foray into telling this story of what was happening. What separated you out from, let's say, other journalists who were just simply reporting the news, like this happened here, to someone who starts telling stories? What separates out the story from the news?
Well, I had a sense when I first came to New York and I was a fact checker at New York Magazine, and I was freelancing music journalism for Rolling Stone and the Village Voice and stuff like that. But I had left Ireland just after the IRA hunger strike, the Bobby Sands hunger strike, which was quite a unique, bizarre event.
What was happening?
Well, basically, what happened was that the IRA prisoners had fought for and had been accorded a sort of prisoner of war status, where they were held in camps, where you know, they'd be in a compound with tents and so forth, and they'd control themselves. Margaret Thatcher decided that this was pandering to terrorists. She tried to take this, what they called political or prisoner of war status away, and the IRA prisoners went on a hunger strike. And I think there were like 80 of them on hunger strike at one point, but 10 of them died. Most famously or infamously, Bobby Sands, that, you know, was the first of the 10 to die. And this, that particular event and that whole prison camp, which I'd been in.
Why were you in it?
Because I was arrested by the British Army and charged with, like, supporting the IRA. And so I had a sense of this fucking amazingly bizarre and unique place that was like a crucible for what was going on in Northern Ireland. And I wrote a play about it. Because I didn't, there had been a lot of journalism written, but I thought nobody's written a play about this that kind of gets inside what took place in the camp. There was a lot of banal stuff, and I wrote a play called The Tunnel. And I took it to a guy called Jim Sheridan, who was running the Irish Arts Centre on West 51st, between 10th and 11th, still there. And Jim took the play and put it on. And it was by off Broadway standards pretty successful. It ran for 6 months.
Wow.
And then Sheridan came to me and said he wanted to turn it into a movie, but he wanted to shoot the movie within the theater itself because it was all set within a hut in this prison camp. And I got sort of semi-decent reviews, and I'm like, oh, you know, I'm not sure, maybe. And he said to me, famously or infamously, he said, well, I'm going to have to do this. I'm going to write this script about Christy Brown, you know, and maybe shoot this film. And I said, oh, yeah, you know, Drunken Irish Paraplegic, that'll be a fucking big hit. And that turned into My Left Foot.
Are you kidding?
Yeah. So Jim went off and, you know, wrote and directed Daniel Day-Lewis and My Left Foot. And I ran the Irish Arts Centre for the next year. I was like the artistic director while he was away.
And so did you start to think, oh my gosh, this is accessible to me, the taking this piece of suffering that had already translated into a play, because the journalism, as you said, was banal, and it is possible to turn something horrific into a movie.
No, I never thought of it as like horrific into a movie. I thought that if you want to transmit the emotions that you'd experienced and the passion that people had, you had to find a universal language for that rather than the local politics that bored people or turned them off.
So what do you mean by the universal language? Because suffering happens in all forms, personal, political, historical.
But I'm not interested in suffering. I mean, I am interested in suffering. I'm interested in alleviating it. What I'm most interested in is people who overcome that or deal with it and rise above it. The capacity to take that suffering and turn it into something good, or to challenge evil in a way on an ordinary personal level, to find, you know, as John Lennon's song, Working Class Hero, is kind of it's kind of ironic. But I actually believe in working class heroes, you know, that you can find ordinary people who triumph over extraordinary circumstances.
So this is kind of a side question, but a lot of people feel you sort of have to hit rock bottom in life to kind of make a move up. Do you feel that there could just be sort of a like working class hero is not necessarily a rock bottom, but you could kind of find heroism in kind of this just general wear and daily wear and tear that society does?
I think there's a moment, there's a chemistry where people find a spark. There's something that ignites them or hits something inside them that triggers greatness in a very sort of important yet not sort of I'm struggling here for this, that they come to greatness through just the moment where there's a tipping moment where they say, I'm going to stand up against something, or I'm going to do something, you know, I can't deal with this anymore. Like the Great Network movie, you know, where...
Yeah. What does he say? I can't take... I forget the exact quote now. It's famous. I'm mad as hell and I can't take it.
I'm mad as hell, I'm not taking it anymore. But he was mad as hell, you know? Yeah.
So what ignited you? What was the moment to ignite you?
No, I don't think there's moments you remember. For me, what ignited me was the knowing that I could write drama that people would be moved by, that they would empathize.
Why drama? Like, what at this point had most influenced you from an artistic point of view?
Well,
as opposed to writing nonfiction about the politics or the stories or whatever.
You know, I mean, I worked for great journalists. I worked for Pete Hamill, Jimmy Breslin, Peter Maas. At New York Magazine, at that time, when I was a fact checker and their researcher, I worked for the best. But I understood that drama, if you get drama right, and mostly through movies, that if you can get drama right, it transcends journalism. It takes people inside a situation that they can never experience. And the reason for that was films like, you know, Schindler's List, Reds, Missing, you know, even Apocalypse Now, great political movies that you feel like you've become part of that situation.
And it's interesting because, like, Schindler's List is a great example. Mm. It's a political movie, but obviously even, like, Hitler is never seen or mentioned. It's just about this guy, Oscar Schindler. And then, of course, the general or a commander played by Ralph Fiennes.
Yeah.
So you don't necessarily have to deal with kind of, like, even in Hotel Rwanda, we actually have never understand what the full political drama is. It's just very clear what is happening and what the story is.
No, it's about boiling it down to, it's a distillation of boiling those emotions down to their essence, and then presenting that in a universal way. Like, I mean, the way Hotel Rwanda happened was, at the time, I was trying to write a script about Liberia, Sierra Leone, and boy soldiers and all of that time, because it was like being ignored. It was just when Charles Taylor was in charge of Liberia, and I thought, this is the most outrageous, crazy thing, and nobody's doing anything about it. And so I tried to write a script, and in the middle of that, my agent gave me a script by Keir Pearson, this guy who was an editor at... I think he was at the New York Times at the time. Anyway, and in his script was the story of Paul Rousey Sabagina. You know, this guy who, an ordinary hotel manager, who actually had like Western, had been taught in Belgium and was, you know, sort of Euro sycophant. And suddenly he was put in a position where he had to rescue his family. And then that family expanded into saving this whole hotel and then the people who came in there. And I thought, this is a way to tell the Rwandan genocide, which is pretty incomprehensible to anyone.
It's totally incomprehensible, which is why, do you think if you had actually went into the explanation of the genocide, it would have taken away from the artistry of the movie?
But there were certain things I recognized from Northern Ireland. There was, you know, politicians using ordinary people's fear to manipulate them into a position of becoming extremist. And there were a couple of the things about the Rwandan genocide that, I mean, the Hutu militia, when I was turning it into a film, the Hutu militia had these incredibly colorful outfits that they had. And I started to see this division okay, the Hutu militia are in these crazy shirts. You know, the UN are in these blue helmets. The Hutu army are in the army uniforms, and the Tutsi refugees are basically in there. I had like color division. Here's the way to explain who's going on here. It's basically hate. You know, it's like fear. The Hutu majority population are in fear of the Tutsi stealing their land. It was a common denominator that you see in the Middle East, that I saw in Northern Ireland, that you see in Asia.
It's interesting because in the movie, you almost get a little confused, like, because everyone's hating everyone else.
Yeah.
So sometimes you don't know who's shooting at who.
Right.
But the core story, you know, the love story, the saving story, the fact that it almost the Schindler's List-like story where he's using the hotel to save hundreds or even over 1,000 refugees. Yeah. That becomes the core thing. And so, again, it's this, you sort of like distill the suffering down to its essence of fear and then use that to tell the story, to move the story along.
I mean, it's hard to take the ordinary person and put them in that situation. And I'm always looking for who is the audience in any movie? You know, what character is the surrogate for the audience? Like in Hotel Rwanda, it was probably Sophie, the wife, rather than Paul.
Hmm.
Because she's the suffering person. She's, you know, she's watching this. And in the Name of the Father, which I
that's really interesting, because so just for people who haven't even seen it, there's the guy who's the hero, played by Don Cheadle, who's almost this, he almost becomes larger than life once he realizes his mission of saving all these 1,200 refugees and all he stores in the or he saves through the hotel. Mm-hmm. But then his wife, I didn't think of it that way. She's the ordinary person experiencing this.
She's the working class hero. Because Paul was always, he was initially selfish. He's motivated by his sort of, you know, Europhile
kind of, worried about losing his job.
Losing his job, and he wants to look after the Westerners, and the whites sell him out at the end of the day, and he's stuck there, and he's still bargaining with the militia and so forth. The purity of the thing is Tatiana, who's watching him and saying, "No, this is what you're going to do. You can't shuffle me off until some evacuation." And I wrote In the Name of the Father, which I wrote with Jim Sheridan, and he directed, which was about a guy called Jerry Conlon, who was
Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yeah, right. But in that film, his father, played by Pete Postlethwaite, was the great working class hero. He was the father who came over to try to rescue his son, and in trying to rescue his son, was imprisoned. And it was actually, we often say this, it was basically the story of Pinocchio. You know, it's the bad child who's swallowed by the whale, and the father goes into the belly of the whale and rescues him, and the child becomes a good child, and the father dies, which was the In the Name of the Father story. But it was, again, it was Pete Postlethwaite, the actor, who personified this nobility of the ordinary person who does something great. And it's the same with Schindler. If you look at Schindler's List, missing Jack Lemmon's great movie about the Chilean, about the Pinochet, the Pinochet years and that coup, and what else? The Killing Fields. You know, there are. It's all the way to tell a story to a universal population is to get them engaged with a character who they can empathize with.
And so it's not necessarily Oscar Schindler or, you know, I don't even know how to pronounce the name, the Don Cheadle character in Hotel Rwanda. It's the person that they're reflecting off of almost, like in this case, in Hotel Rwanda, the wife.
Yeah, to some degree. But an Oscar Schindler, I mean, the great thing about Oscar Schindler was he was such a rogue,
So he had his own vulnerability, as opposed to Don Cheadle kind of rose above that vulnerability.
Well, at the same time, to some extent, not quite as with Oscar Schindler. You know, and it's one of my, I wish at the end of it, and it's a genius movie, that Oscar had to remain quite the rogue that he was, you know. But But it has to be people that you know and recognize. They can't be like, you know, goddesses or great, like huge hero, kind of plastic heroes or superheroes.
Right.
I'm always looking for real characters who are people who have transcended the situation they're in.
So I'm just trying.
Aaron Brockovich is a good character. You know, that's a classic.
Yeah,
example.
So that's a great one too. Yeah. So it seems like now I'm piecing together, and just totally correct me where I'm wrong. There's kind of this global catastrophe, not global, but there's a systemic kind of catastrophe that's happening someplace, whether it's in Aaron Brockovich, the poisoning by a big corporation of some land, or in Rwanda, there's this genocide that nobody could possibly understand. Like, it's an insane genocide. So there, and you don't even have to explain all the details. We just have to understand that fear exists and it's insane. And then there's this character that somehow his arc or her arc is to transcend from ordinary person to almost larger than life person. And then there's kind of the stories around that create human frailty and vulnerability and fear, where we, the audience, can feel fear. So for instance, I've never been to Rwanda. I actually don't know the details at all of the genocide, other than the fact that it's insane, nor do you explain it in the movie, but I can yet relate completely to the fear. And I can also aspire to be the Don Cheadle character. So I'm feeling both. So I feel like there's some formula in there, not a direct formula, but something where it lights up your creativity.
It's not a formula. It's like recognizing that in any given situation, people can transcend their ordinary life and come to a place where they stand up for something, and that we can, that gives us a hope as well. But that it's not ridiculous. It's not like they suddenly take off and fly and catch someone falling from a building.
Right, it took Don Cheadle a while. It took him many episodes.
But you could and should be Don Cheadle in that situation. You could and should be Oscar Schindler. You know, you could and should be, I forget the name of the guy in The Killing Field. These are people who we should aspire to be. Not on any superhero level, but just on a level of common decency. So that when you leave the cinema, you feel... The big thing for me about cinema at the moment is the only emotions that Hollywood is interested in sending the people out the door with is like, golly gee, wow, their eyes are spinning because they've seen so much explosions and their ears are fucking ringing.
I'm Ant-Man. Yeah. I could shrink down save lives.
I could give a shit. I want people to go out with like tears running down their face, their heart pumping, and feeling, this is my next door neighbor and I should be them. Those are like deeper emotions. We've given up on deeper emotions in the cinema.
No, and I felt that in Hotel Rwanda. You feel like you can, it's almost like this little injection you get. You feel like you could be better than yourself by just aspiring to be the Don Cheadle character or the Oscar Schindler like character who is sacrificing his own life to save all these thousands of people or 1,200 people in the Hotel Rwanda case. So but again, I'm really just fascinated by the idea of transforming suffering into creativity. Like, what do you see in a historical or political or current story that you could say, I could do something with this and transform it into art?
Well, I mean, it's overcoming suffering that I'm interested in rather than tapping into it. And I think I'm not like mining for stories. Here's what to tell. But I want, you know, you look at situations in the world today and it's got, I mean, we used to think the 20th century with like the horrors of the Holocaust and the genocide and all was like the worst century ever. And then we've moved into the 21st, where we've actually reverted to the fucking, not just the 15th century, but the 8th century.
Right.
You know, we're back with the caliphate and, you know, the medieval crusades. And suddenly you're like, wow. And there's refugees swarming across from, you know, the Middle East into Europe. And you want to find what's the motivation that can bring people to understand what's going on in Syria at the moment, or what's going on in Mexico, or what's going... I want to take audiences into that place.
So it's an interesting combination between journalism, where you just kind of dictate what the events are happening, and storytelling, where you sort of find this core emotion that can be really explored and this arc of character. And where would you say is the gap? Like, clearly, I don't want to use the word selling out, even though I just said that phrase, but clearly you're not doing Jurassic Park 4. You know, that's not on your agenda for the future. And where's the gap between the storytelling you do and the Jurassic Parks, which do sell $1 billion worth of tickets?
Well, that's, I mean, that you have to accept that, you know, it's like accepting Rupert Murdoch and the New York Post and stuff. That's what's, you know, and Fox News and reality television. It's what people want to escape their own, not their mundane lives. They just, as escapism, they do that. If you're dealing in deeper subjects, then it requires more time to be spent. It's not, I don't find any more nobility in what I'm doing over somebody, you know, doing the sixth episode of Star Wars or whatever.
But why? Because it seems like, again, I watch Hotel Rwanda and I feel nobility. I feel like I can be this Don Cheadle character.
Yeah, but maybe that's what... I want to tap into other emotions that people need to feel. I think in entertainment at the minute, we're on a serious sugar rush. You know, if you go into the cinema, you're just going to get high on the flash bang of it all and that. And you got to understand that, you know, fucking all brand and healthy foods are just as good and they can actually taste as good. Or you can leave the cinema with a different feeling. Because I do remember, even when I was a kid growing up, you know, my mom used to take me to these, what's her name? There were these old sort of classic weepy movies that they'd make. But then, and in the 60s, and the 70s and the 80s, the great films were tapping into deeper, different emotions. You know, like Apocalypse Now and The Deer Hunter and, the great political movies of the time, Costa Gravis and... You came out with a different emotion from the cinema than you get now. The only time you get those emotions is between like October and January when the Oscars are, suddenly you get hit up with like the important movies. But I think it's very satisfying to come away from a movie where you feel you've been moved in a way that you're just not being entertained, you know?
So let's say I'm an aspiring young filmmaker and I'd like to do what you've done in fashion, that sort of career you've done without necessarily going to Hollywood and signing up for Ant-Man 4 or whatever. What should I be looking for in terms of learning or learning how to write or learning how to, what process should I start thinking about?
I don't know. I mean, I think if you look at the, if you take like Cary Fukunaga, who just did Beast of No Nation, and he did True Detective.
Okay. Yeah. And he wrote every single word of True Detective.
But before that...
Very unusual for a TV series.
You know, he did Sin Nombre, and he did a short film that was the basis of that. He's a classic example of going and finding something. Like, his short film was basically about Mexican illegals trying to get into the United States. And those... transmitting emotion... I mean, we're in the business of communication, right? That's all of us. This is what this is about. We're communicating with each other. Film is about communication. If you can communicate emotion in its rawest level, then that's how you're going to be successful.
And then, so stupid question again, How do you think about, because there's sort of, as you said before, with Sugar Rush, there are very sugary ways to communicate emotion, and then there are very real ways to communicate emotion. And if, it, you know, you obviously weren't at the Rwanda genocide, but you related it to your experiences in Ireland, what's kind of a method of sort of feeling that emotion in the inside and putting it out on the paper in a real way that's not saccharine?
Well, you know, I'm not... Look, I think a lot of it is some of it's personal experience that you have to do the work. You have to talk to people and feel that and do the research and feel that viscerally to actually, you can't go to UCLA film school and know how people feel in Aleppo. You know, you can't do that. It doesn't transmit. You can go to UCLA film school and know how people feel on fucking Star XYZ. You know, that's okay.
that's where I normally live.
Well, but that's an invention. You know, what real life suffering and the little nuances of what take place in that is that's personal experience. And you've got to get out and work with that. And then, for when we were doing Hotel Rwanda, and even in this, then The Promise, the film I'm doing at the moment, I had a sort of mantra or a catchword, and it's Peoria. And the thing is, if they don't get it in Peoria, Illinois, you've failed, right? You have to be able to crystallize and turn that drama into something that communicates not just in Peoria, but in Belfast and in Beirut and in Bangkok, in some way to universalize that. And that's about finding those, you know, universal moments of suffering and emotion and joy.
Well, you mentioned joy, and it brings me, it made me think when I was watching Hotel Rwanda, there's these intense, horrible moments. Like I'm not giving any spoilers, but obviously there's dead bodies everywhere.
Yeah. It's 12 years old now, so spoilers.
Yeah, no need for spoilers. If you haven't seen the movie, you suck, whatever. But, in the middle of that, though, the Don Cheadle character is still laughing and joking with his wife. They're trying to find those moments of joy, which I thought was very real, too. Like, you're not just kind of trying to beat this message. It's not about the message. It's about the human experience.
Yeah, no, you've all, I mean, there's a sort of structure to it as well. You can't always be, I did one movie that was unrelentingly bleak called Reservation Road, which was about...
Funniest movie ever.
Yeah.
No, just kidding. Yeah.
Which we all call the Dead Child in the Road movie, you know? But, and and I learned that you've got to, even within the worst horror, there's moments of joy that people have, or humor, or laughter, or whatever. The audience needs a relief valve, you know? And it's not that they're even planted. It's just, I remember even from, I look back on Belfast now, and when I grew up, and I remember the funny, crazy, stupid stuff along with the horrific stuff.
You know, so you did a short movie, The Shore, which won an Academy Award, about your experiences in Belfast to some extent. Yeah. And so do you ever see yourself again returning to that?
Yeah, I'm going to try and do a feature film out of The Shore. The great thing about The Shore was, it was during, I'd just written Inside Man 2 for Spike. We were trying to, because I rewrote, I was the second writer on Inside Man with Spike, and then he wanted to do Inside Man 2, and then I did a version of that, and there was some other shit going on in Hollywood, and it was one of those constantly going into like big story meetings with 15 people saying, you know, what if he turned into like a wasp and flew out the window? I'm sitting there trying to smile.
Well, what do you do in that situation? Like, so presumably they're pulling you in because you're going to be able to take this comic book-like scenario and get the raw emotion out of it. My guess is why they're bringing
you in.
Yeah,
they're in for some form, exactly.
And so what do you do in that case? Okay, I'm the wasp and I'm going to like shrink down and sting people.
You know, I could say stab myself in the neck.
But you say like, oh, he had a child who died like in the past, and he has a flashback about that, or like, what do you? Well, what's the formula?
There was one point somebody said when we were doing In the Name of the Father. Well, what would happen if like his father escaped or something like that? And I'm like, well, you know, this is a real story. He died in prison, so he can't really. there's a detachment in Hollywood of like, what if this happened, you know? And I'm not the best one to tell these horrific like story by comedic, stories, because there's the thing about going to these story meetings in Hollywood is you come in. And there's 12 people from the studio. And they're all clever.
All geniuses.
They're all geniuses. But they are. They're all very clever. But, you know, the head of the studio or the deputy is there. And then the next one down. And then you've got 10 people who work for them. And they all desperately feel as though if they don't say something, they have no contribution to make. Or they're not... And the best thing they could actually do is like shut the fuck up and say nothing, you know, and let the person. But they all come in with ideas.
They have to say something.
Yeah. I mean, there was one rewrite I did of a film where with a big movie star. And I went to these meetings and I ended up getting 70 pages of notes. And I said, then why don't you just fucking shoot the notes and save yourselves all the money for paying for me? You know, you know, a normal script's 110 pages and they'd give me 70 pages of notes on the script. But
And what did you add to that script? Just like, I'm just trying to understand, like, what do you bring to those big Hollywood-esque meetings?
What do I bring to it? I bring their hope that you'll fix something that's bad. You're brought in to fix, you know, you're usually brought in as the second writer to fix something that's not working.
Well, what might not be working?
That usually the whole fucking story.
But like, is there like, was it too much like they focused on like plot without human emotion, or like what happens, what goes off the rail?
They start with a concept. They have a concept rather than an intrinsic story that comes out of something, you know, that comes out of something that's actually exists in reality, or that has a personal vision of someone who's invented it. They come up with the concept, and then they start developing that concept. And everyone, you have six people who are in the studio. And they each have different ideas about that concept. And then they bring in a writer and they articulate that concept. And then he has his spin on the concept, but it doesn't actually match theirs.
I see.
You need, you know, you write books, right? You actually need a concept that's held together by one person who has a vision. Once you start chiseling away at that, then you start... diminishing the concept itself.
So you brought in to kind of like say, look, okay, let's take a step back and fill in an underlying
This doesn't work. Can you do this? Can you do that? Mm-hmm. And it's usually a lot of money and, you know, you're like, okay, yeah, I'll give that a try. And a lot of times it does work because it's sort of journeyman work stuff, you know? It's like building blocks of a story and how this works. And but often then... your idea doesn't match with what the people around the table are. It's not, for me, look, that works a lot of time in Hollywood. I'm just a guy who wants to tell a particular story with particular emotions, and I need to be in control of that, and I shouldn't wander into this, like, great area of let's fix things here, like this and that. You know, it's sort of, for me, you've got to be so invested in the story that you take it from start to finish. And if something within it doesn't work dramatically, then because you're invested in it, you know how to fix, you know how to join.
Right, you're like part of the whole story, every moment of it.
Yeah, I can't deal with the, let's make this all up collectively, you know?
So again, to the aspiring young filmmaker, you've already mentioned several movies that have inspired you and motivated you. What are some books they could read learn?
For me, the aspiring young filmmaker today has everything at their, you know, at their disposal. It was always for me the intro was to go to a theater, the Irish Art Center, as it so happened with Jim Sheridan, because you immediately become involved with actors, set designer, director, producer, like local theater. Get involved in something practical. Don't be sending a script to Hollywood. It's going to be toilet paper. Not even that. It's just going to be recycled. They're not even going to wipe their ass with it. You know, just try to get involved yourself. And because of the way we work today, the internet, the D5 camera, GarageBand, you can do your own movie. You write a script, write a short film, shoot it, see how it goes. If you have a concept and you think that can make it fly, then you've got your own distribution network. You've got everything's at your disposal. You don't have to go to Hollywood. In fact, if you avoid that there, you're far better off, you know? So that's my advice to anyone who's aspiring to be a writer, director, whatever, is to do it yourself. Find out, join a local theater or find out a group of people who you can work with and put something together that you think's unique. And on the internet, on the web, if it ain't unique, you're going to fucking know about it very quickly, you know? So there's the conventional way of bursting into Hollywood, I think, is gone completely now. You know, this let's send a script and hope someone reads it. And nobody reads scripts that are sent. You know, forget about it.
Well, look, Terry George, Hotel Rwanda. We're going to have you back on again with we talked about one genocide. We're going to have you on again with the next genocide in a few months. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for
I appreciate it. It was super inspirational. And thank you very much.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network at stansberryradio.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.